I think it's fair to say that marriage in our culture, if we want three M's, is mangled, marginalised and misunderstood. There's iconic of the mangling, of course, is same-sex marriage. That's not really the topic I'm going to talk about. That's a topic for another day. But I want to think more about the way that marriage is marginalised because I don't think it's rightly understood. So here are some of the stats to highlight that for us. So we now live in a society where almost two-thirds of people believe that sex outside marriage is not wrong at all. That over the last 25 years, the number of people who believe a couple should marry before having children has halved. It's 50% today compared to 25 years ago. As a consequence, 50% of children are now born outside of marriage. Only 50% of children reach age 16 with two parents. That has huge implications. And 2.5 million children live in single parent homes in the UK, and record numbers in the 45 to 64 year old age bracket now live alone. Those are just some of the sort of statistical indicators of the marginalisation of marriage in our society. Also interesting to look at the advice given to young women. This was back in 1990. The interesting here is the difference in different age brackets. So at that time, from those aged over 50, the advice that they would give to a young woman was to marry without living together first. 60% said that in that age bracket, and 20% said live together with a steady partner and then marry. Go down to the 18 to 34-year-olds, and those stats are reversed, with 60% advising a young woman to live together with a steady partner and then marry. And that was 1990. So I think we all recognise this, that marriage is no longer regarded as the right place to begin a steady sexual relationship, and many people do not see the relevance or necessity of marriage. But the Bible, in contrast to our culture, the Bible says that marriage should be honoured by all, and the marriage bed kept pure, for God will judge the adulterer and all the sexually immoral. Why does the Bible say that? Well, because sex and marriage are God's gift. So we know this, don't we, from Genesis chapter 2. That the Lord God made a woman from the rib he'd taken out of the man, and he brought her to the man. The man said, "This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, for she was taken out of man." For this reason, because of God's work in creation of the man and the woman, for this reason a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and they will become one flesh. The man and the wife were both naked, and they felt no shame. So it is God who has made us male and female. It's God who's created human sexuality, and he has given marriage as a gift to humanity. And here we see marriage creating a new social unit. So the man leaving his father and mother, leaving that family, that social unit, and being bound together with his wife, united to his wife to create a new social unit. But marriage is not merely a social construct. At its heart, it is to be a relationship of passionate intimacy. So this relationship finds its most pleasurable and intense expression in the sexual union of husband and wife. The one fleshing becomes a literal reality physiologically. And God's intention for sex is that it should operate within marriage for husband and wife to enjoy and to celebrate and to strengthen the relational and the emotional bond between them, as William was saying in his first talk this morning. And we know also, don't we, as we read on the Bible, we come to the Song of Songs, and we find that the passionate intimacy of the sexual relationship between a husband and wife is celebrated and given clear biblical endorsement in a symbol-laden erotic love poem. So what is marriage to be? Well, marriage is to be an intimate, passionate relationship bounded by covenant faithfulness. That's what I'll be arguing for in this seminar. And why has God created marriage in that way? Why has God given marriage to us in that form, with that definition to it? And essentially what I want to be saying through the rest of the seminar is he's done so first that it might be a beautiful and a glorious picture of something. And secondly, it is a loving and wise provision. So we're going to be really thinking about those are our two main headings for the rest of this time. Okay. So what is the picture to be, this beautiful and glorious picture that marriage is? Well, it's to be a picture of God himself. So turn with me, if you've got a Bible, to Ezekiel chapter 16. We'll just pick this up at verse 7. Here is God rehearsing how he dealt with the people of Israel. But notice, observe the language that God uses to describe his people and his dealings with his people here in Ezekiel 16. I'm reading for the 2011 NIV. So verse 7, I made you grow like a plant of the field. You grew and developed and entered puberty. He's talking about Israel. Your breasts had formed and your hair had grown, yet you were stark naked. Later I passed by, and when I looked at you, I saw that you were old enough for love. I spread the corner of my garment over you and covered your naked body. I gave you my solemn oath and entered into a covenant with you, declares the Sovereign Lord, and you became mine. I bathed you with water and washed the blood from you and put ointments on you. I clothed you with an embroidered dress and put sandals of fine leather on you. I dressed you in fine linen and covered you with costly garments. So God picturing the relationship that he has with Israel as a marital relationship and using sexual language to describe that. And but also note the covenant faithfulness at the end of verse 8 and his beautifying of his people. Just turn on, if you would, to Hosea. If you can find Hosea, it's Hosea chapter 2 we're turning to. Hosea 2, verse 14. Again, God talking about his people and saying, therefore, I am now going to allure her. It's wooing language. He's going to woo his people. I will lead her into the wilderness and speak tenderly to her. Verse 16, in that day, declares the Lord, you will call me my husband. You will no longer call me my master or Baal. And then let's go to the more familiar passage, Ephesians. Just to rehearse the verses that William will look at later. Let's remind ourselves what Paul says in Ephesians 5:31. So he's been given instructions to wives and to husbands. And then he roots what he's saying in the verse from Genesis 2 when he says, Ephesians 5:31, for this reason a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. This is a profound mystery, but I am talking about Christ and the church. So that verse from Ephesians, from Genesis chapter 2, which we know is about man and woman, about husband and wife, is about the human sexual and marital relationship, Paul says, ultimately is actually about Christ and the church. That's where it finds its fulfillment. And so we won't look it up, but when we turn to Revelation 21, when we come to the consummation of all things, one of the images of the people of God that is used is that the people of God are a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. And who's the husband? Christ. So where is everything heading? Everything is heading to the greatest wedding of all, and the greatest marriage of all, between Christ and his people. So what do we see in God's approach to his people? We see intimate, passionate concern, a costly relationship, but one bounded by covenant faithfulness. There is the intimacy and passion of the relationship, but also the covenant faithfulness of the relationship. And so marriage, human marriage, has been given to us in our experience in this world as a picture both of fidelity, of lifelong faithfulness, and of passionate intimacy, because that is what God is like. So that both marriage, as we experience it, and celibacy outside of marriage, remaining sexually pure, that they're both signs which are pointing us to God himself. So if we're married and we're saying yes to the passionate intimacy of marriage, and we're saying yes to the fidelity and the faithfulness of marriage, then we're saying that is what God is like. We're saying that intimacy and faithfulness belong together with God. And we want to signpost that in our marriages. Or if I'm single and I'm keeping myself from sexual intimacy, then I'm also using my sexuality to witness to what God is like, because he is not a God who is all over you one night and then abandons you the next morning. He's not a God who will pursue a relationship of passionate intimacy for a month or 2 months or 6 months and then abandon you. He's not that sort of God. So I won't use my sexuality in that sort of way, actually by exercising sexual purity in that area, I'm also witnessing to how with God faithfulness and intimacy go together. Of course, there are other sorts of close relationship open to people who are single, but they're not to be sexual ones. And to seek sex without pledging covenant faithfulness is to tear apart the beautiful picture that God has given us in marriage. To seek sexual intimacy without pledging faithfulness is a denial of the glory of God, as it rips apart the most profound revelation in creation, I think, that we have as to God's own character. So that we need to understand that marriage is not just a handy illustration that it so happens is useful when we're talking about God and Christ and the church, but actually marriage is a picture of the Creator etched into human flesh. So much so that actually every civilization has found its way to heterosexual marriage as a social construct essential to the holding together of human societies. Because there's an instinct in us that is saying that sexual intimacy and faithfulness need to belong together, that comes from being made in the image of God. However much we might live in a society that is seeking to suppress that image of God and suppress that truth about God. So marriage reveals God. It's a beautiful picture. And whether we're married or single, marriage is also pointing us forward in anticipation and in longing for the consummation of all things when Christ will be united with his church, his bride. So whether we're married and enjoying marriage or struggling in marriage, whether we're single or and struggling with singleness or enjoying singleness, we're being pointed forward to that ultimate relationship, Christ and his church. So we see that marriage is to be a beautiful and a glorious picture of God himself, which is why this matters so much. This is why this is such a big deal. and that we're not free to reinvent marriage in some new terms that we as want to define for our society, but actually we've got a God-given picture, we're to reflect that, and as we take on board the God-given picture and live it out, we are imaging God and revealing his glory and actually pointing to the fulfillment of all things in Christ and his church. So that's the first half of what I want to say. Tempting to pause for questions at that point, but I think fear the danger is that we then spend the rest of our time discussing it, and I wouldn't get to say the other half, and I do want to say the other half, okay? So I'm going to move on and say it's not only a beautiful and glorious picture, and if I move fast enough, we will have time for questions and discussion. It's a beautiful and glorious picture, it's also a loving and wise provision. Here's an interesting survey. I think this is a fascinating survey. National Survey of Sexual Attitudes and Lifestyles. Stats here from 1990 and 2000. They're currently processing the more recent statistics. Percentage reporting behaviour is sometimes or always wrong. Blue in 1990, the pale green colour in 2000. Now, it's this. You see the stats in the middle, those who are saying that one-night stands are wrong. From 1990 to 2000, the percentage, men on the left, women on the right, the percentage saying that one-night stands are wrong actually drops from 1990 to 2000. We're probably not surprised by that, okay? So fewer people will say that one-night stands are always or sometimes wrong in 2000. But look what happens at the bottom. Unfaithfulness in cohabitation rises. Those who will say that unfaithfulness in cohabitation is wrong, that rises from 1990 to 2000. To figures up there in sort of the 90%. Don't know what the exact number is represented there. But the vast majority of people, and an increasing number of people, saying that unfaithfulness in cohabitation is wrong. So, why not... why not simply say that, yes, sex and faithfulness belong together, but why do we need marriage? What is wrong with a couple simply declaring their love for each other and living together? Our society gets it. Faith, if you're in a relationship with somebody, faithfulness matters. So they get it. Intimacy and faithfulness, they belong together in an ongoing relationship. So why not just respect that? Why do we need to add marriage to that? To illustrate that, let's just consider the book by Ian McEwan, Atonement. Here's Keira Knightley and James McAvoy in the film of the book. The book's described as a book in which sex with love, followed by costly faithfulness, is imbued with a deep significance. Well, that seems pretty close to a definition of marriage, doesn't it? Sex with love, followed by costly faithfulness, is imbued with deep significance. And when Robbie and Celia, or Cecilia, first make love and declare their love in words, we're told that Robbie had no religious belief, but it was impossible not to think of an invisible presence or witness in the room, and that these words spoken aloud were like signatures on an unseen contract. So why is that not enough? Why not the signatures on an unseen contract? Why bother with marriage? Why do we need to turn it into a visible contract? Why do we need a piece of paper? Why bring law into the bedroom? After all, that's what marriage does, doesn't it? Marriage is a legal contract with legal implications. And when marriages go wrong, it takes lawyers and courts and judges to sort out the mess. But isn't it marriage creating the mess? Why complicate love with marriage? That's the question, isn't it? But to approach an answer to that, I think we need to just think about the twin poles of marriage. Marriage is a rather strange thing, really. Because marriage is at one and the same time the most public of things and the most private and personal of things. The very public nature of marriage is symbolised by the wedding day, isn't it? A wedding is precisely not an intimate candlelit dinner for two. The Greek word for marriage is gamos, and in the New Testament, in the Greek translation of the Old Testament, the word gamos most commonly refers to a wedding banquet or a feast. We don't have a banquet for two, do you? Not really. Or a feast for two. A wedding is a public celebration of the marriage. In contrast, sexual intimacy is the most private and personal of things. And the private nature of marriage in our culture is symbolised by the honeymoon, isn't it? You know, for all the jokes about the best man hiding under the bed, you know, it's not the done thing, is it? Everyone, you know, bride and groom are to be left alone to enjoy their privacy in their sexual union. So marriage is both a private and a public thing. And that accommodation is a slightly strange one, because when you marry, you, at the very least, you are giving your consent to sex with the person that you are marrying. There's much more that's promised, but that's an essential component. And the bride and groom give their consent to this most private and intimate of things in the most public of settings. You get that? And I rather suspect that thinking about this takes us to the heart of the misunderstanding of marriage today. It's because there is a cherishing of the private, but there is a failure to understand the importance of the public. Our society only gets one pole of this, not the other pole. The private is highly valued, but the public is not. And if the public aspect of marriage is not valued, then why choose marriage instead of simply declaring your love and moving in together? Yeah, brides do, you know, they long for their wedding days, but I think if they don't understand the value of the public dimension, they're longing for the wedding day for the wrong reasons. It's about being, you know, having your day, and this, but not really appreciating why it's important that their love and their consent to a sexual relationship be given publicly. And rather quickly, I want to just try and set out why the public dimension of marriage is so important as a wise and loving provision from God for the health of our sexual relationships. So if you look at the capital letters, you'll notice that it is CPR. Okay, that is deliberate. It's meant to be a bit of an aid memoir to you, okay? Okay, so dead body, no, not dead body, that won't do, will it? But, you know, CPR on the person whose heart has stopped functioning, for revival. So CPR for healthy sexual relationships, okay? Slightly corny, I know, but it might stick with you. Really trying to sum up what Christopher Ashe has to say in his great work on marriage. But the public side of marriage brings with it clarity, protection, and reinforcement. So first of all, in terms of clarity, public marriage removes ambiguity. That the people who are married know that they are married, and everyone else knows it. By contrast, all other sorts of sexual relationships are surrounded by a haze of ambiguity. Let's think about what happens when a couple start having sex and move in to live together. Well, usually it's understood that they've consented to an ongoing sexual relationship. Usually, there's some understanding that that means not getting into a sexual relationship with anybody else as long as they're living together. But even that may not be clear. Often there is an expectation by at least one of them that the relationship has a future. But it's not clear they both think that way, or how long is that future to be. But very often the degree of commitment between the two people is actually ambiguous and may often be unequal. Perhaps the woman hopes that the relationship will be more lasting than the man does. He may not even have thought about how long he expects the relationship to last. He's just drifted into it. And without a public commitment, there's the ambiguity of the situation just introduces uncertainty and insecurity into the relationship. And then you can add that in terms of public perception, other people, the relationship is surrounded by an awkward and uncertain and sometimes a painful ambiguity. How do the couple expect their family and friends to view their relationship? Without public marriage, there is no clear statement to clarify the situation. The very first thing that marriage does is bring clarity to what is the status of the relationship. What are the expectations on each side? How are other people to view the relationship? Secondly, marriage is intended to bring protection. It's interesting that one of the terms that the Bible uses, you see it in the second translation of the same verse, which is a more literal translation, it is one of term for sexual intercourse is uncovering nakedness. So NIV says, Leviticus 20:17, if a man marries his sister, the daughter of either his father or his mother, and they have sexual relations, it is a disgrace. They must be cut off before the eyes of their people. He has dishonored his sister and will be held responsible. In a more literal translation, if there is a man who takes his sister, his father's daughter or his mother's daughter, so that he sees her nakedness and she sees his nakedness, it is a disgrace. And they shall be cut off in the sight of the sons of their people. He has uncovered his sister's nakedness, and he bears his guilt. And there are other places where the same sort of language is used. And to describe sexual intercourse as uncovering nakedness highlights two things. First, that in the wrong context, it's actually a cause for shame. But secondly, that the whole dynamic of a sexual relationship brings with it perhaps the deepest level of vulnerability that human beings are capable of. That there's no true intimacy without vulnerability. You know, without our clothes, we feel vulnerable, don't we? As well as rather embarrassed. Out in public, at least. Maybe embarrassed for all sorts of reasons, But that sense of vulnerability, and that is there in sex. The vulnerability means that there is the possibility of being deeply hurt and deeply damaged. For which reason protection is necessary? That sex without security will be, in the end, sex filled with anxiety and the fear of hurt. And when we make ourselves vulnerable, it's only safe to do so in the context of some security. If you are staying in someone else's home and you're going to take a bath, it only feels secure to do so if there is a lock on the bathroom door. Does it not? Which of us dares to take a bath in somebody else's home when there is no lock on the door? Marriage is like the lock on the bathroom door. It's intended to provide the secure context in which we can make ourselves vulnerable in safety. And in the Bible, safe sex is marital sex because when marriage is properly honoured, marriage protects us. And so the public dimension is intended to protect the private dimension. Of course, in a fallen world, the protection may fail. The lock may break. It may fail painfully. But it's better than having no protection at all. In what way does it protect? Well, first, it's protection against inadvertent intrusion. So at the very simplest level, the publicity surrounding a marriage and the public status of a marriage is protection against unwitting intrusion on the relationship. Think of locking the bathroom door. You don't want somebody else wandering into the bathroom inadvertently, invading your private vulnerability. Others need to know who is married to whom so they know who is off limits. that the person who is married should be regarded as being unavailable as a potential partner for anybody else. We need to know where the boundaries lie, and public marriage makes those boundaries clear. Again, in a fallen world, the boundaries are not always respected. But let's at least know where the boundaries lie. And then there's protection in the matter of consent. So people in our culture like to think of themselves as free-floating moral agents who can consent to enter or decline any proffered sexual relationship at will. But actually the reality for many is quite different. I think probably especially for many young women, that they're not free agents making liberated choices, but actually they're the tragic victims of physical and emotional coercion. Our culture wants to say, well, no one has the right to interfere with what consenting adults agree to do. And that sort of freedom appears to be very attractive, but in practice, that freedom of the individual often means a psychological, if not physical, manipulation of the weak by the strong. I can think of many situations like that, where somebody, a young person comes and actually says that they've been pressurized into a sexual intimacy that they didn't really want. They weren't a free-floating moral agent making their free choices in a liberated way. They were being manipulated and coerced by somebody else. And when consent to a sexual relationship is hidden and private, when it happens behind a closed door late at night with the lights dimmed, then family and friends have no opportunity whatsoever to protect a young person from their own foolishness or from manipulation by somebody else. So what marriage does is it makes the matter of consent public. And so it leaves room for the counsel of others. It at least gives family and friends some opportunity to encourage or to discourage the proposed sexual relationship. So over and against the individualism of our society, honouring marriage affirms the value of community protection. We belong to communities, to family, we have friends, and actually we're to protect each other. And young people especially need to be protected from rash judgments and exploitation. More so today than ever before. And keeping consent to a sexual relationship public in the context of marriage aids that sort of protection. Finally, with protection, well, marriage provides protection for the weak when marriage breaks down. For all that we can say about marriage being a glorious picture and all the benefits of marriage, we live in a fallen world where marriages will break, will fail. But even when marriage breaks, there should be a benefit to having been married in terms of the protection that's provided for the weaker or the innocent party. God's call to faithfulness is expressed in marriage, and at the same time, when there is marital breakdown, that should... Society should give expression to God's displeasure at unfaithfulness and God's desire for justice. So people should not just be able to walk out of relationships without being held to account and without being held to their obligations. It's a matter of justice. And that protection society can offer and give when marriage is public and legally recognised. And then finally, reinforcement. So clarity, protection, reinforcement. Reinforcement of faithfulness with public vows. So we've seen that in God's will, sexual intimacy and lifelong faithfulness belong together. Faithfulness that excludes all rivals and faithfulness that persists over time, and marriage brings the reinforcement of faithfulness with public vows. In other words, another vital aspect of public marriage is that it's intended to help me keep my promises. So essential to marriage is the giving of consent and the making of promises in public in front of witnesses. So the marriage ceremony includes the phrase, I call upon these persons here present to witness that I, AB, I've never heard anyone called AB. Have anyone actually married anyone who was called AB, who happened to be marrying CD, to be my lawful husband or wife. So those getting married specifically call on everyone else who's gathered there to witness the promises that they are making and to support them in keeping the promises and to hold them to account for doing so. And the human witness gives expression to God's witness of the marriage. And just as God holds us to account for whether we keep our promises, then actually human beings are expected to do the same. And willingness to pledge love publicly in front of married witnesses is a vital matter. Because again, with our sinfulness in a fallen world, there's all the difference between the fragility of a promise made in private and the strength of a promise made in public when we call upon others to witness our promise. It's all the difference between a couple whispering some promises to each other privately beside the fireside and actually pledging those promises in public. Because when I pledge myself in public, my whole personal integrity is on the line. If I break my word, then everyone will know I've broken my word. And as a consequence, it's harder to break my word even if I want to. Of course, making my vows in public is not a guarantee of lasting marriage, but it is a defense. It is a defense against my own sinfulness, my tendency to unfaithfulness, my tendency to instability, the instability of my will. As Christopher Ash puts it, we vacillate, we chop and change, we're tossed around by the winds of emotion, by storms of suffering, and by shakings of personal insecurity. So the public pledging of ourselves in front of a community of people is intended to reinforce that as a safeguard against our own instability. So declarations of love are not to be trusted unless there is a willingness to pledge them publicly. So that the test of true love is actually the willingness to pledge that love in front of witnesses. Because if my love is true, then why would I hold back from that? Why would I not be prepared to pledge it in front of witnesses? That to love enough for sex is to love enough to pledge that love publicly. And claims of love are called into question when there's a failure to back them up with a public pledge of lifelong faithfulness. So the heart of marriage, public marriage, is the reinforcement of personal integrity with public vows. We affirm publicly that we understand and we accept that intimacy and faithfulness belong together. And whether they realize it or not, that couple getting married are actually imaging the God who made them. And when marriage is rightly honoured in a society, the sincere and serious public pledging of love creates the best context for husband and wife to give themselves to each other without anxiety and with security. Nearly done. So, what is marriage? Marriage is given to us by a loving God for our good. It provides clarity, protection, reinforcement. God gives his commands for our good. It's a loving and wise provision because it functions in those ways, and it's a beautiful and glorious picture of God himself. And whatever our situation, whatever our status in life, we all need to know why marriage is a good thing. Our young people need to be convinced that marriage is a good thing and why it's much more than just a piece of paper. They need to understand why you should not give yourself to another person sexually without the security of marriage. They need to understand that God has given this instruction for our good and not to harm us. But more than that, we and they need our hearts captivated by a better vision than the one that our society sets before us. A vision of imaging the faithfulness of God with our sexuality, both in celibate singleness and in marriage. A vision of reflecting who God is, of demonstrating his glory. And we know, we can see all around us, that without that vision, our society is perishing. Only half the children in our country reaching the age of 16 with two parents. Estates which are father deserts. I was at a conference this week with some church leaders and chatting to one guy who pastors a church in Liverpool in quite a tough area. And he moved into the church and they tried to do all the things that they'd done in the church they'd come from. Things like run toddler groups and then run a Saturday for the dads of the toddlers in the toddler group. And they did that and only one man turned up. So then he and his wife talked to the women who were the mothers of the toddlers who came to the toddler group. And they didn't have a single man amongst them. So no wonder no dads turned up. Our society is perishing. It needs a better vision. We need to point people to a better way. We need to point people to the one who is a better way. We can do that in our conversation. So I hope that a seminar like this can help us to turn our conversations about sex and marriage into conversations about the faithfulness of God. We can say that marriage is special to us. Marriage is sacred to us. Because it's a picture of how God loves his people passionately in faithfulness. So passionately that Christ gave himself for us on the cross. He died to wash his bride clean. And he's pledged that love in faithfulness. He's made covenant promises. So we can very quickly go from talking about marriage to talking about our God and the gospel and why the two are so intimately connected, can't we? But as we point people to a better way, we also need to do so in our marriages, don't we? Those of us who are married. As we're reminded that marriage is about an intimate, passionate relationship bounded by covenant faithfulness, because that is what God is like. And people need to not only hear that explained, they need to see it lived. So perhaps a seminar like this or a day like this is a wake-up call to some of us to renew our own marriages in the image of God, that we might truly reflect his glory. And better point people to the gospel. Let me finish there. I've very, very cleverly only managed to leave a couple of minutes for questions, but if you're prepared to lose a little bit more of your lunchtime, then we can go on slightly longer. But anyone want to chip in with things that you'd like to ask or to add to that, Carol? It was on the bottom of the slide. 10:13. Yep.
Thank you. Okay.
Okay. Great question. I can answer questions like that all day. Go on. Next one. Another reference. No, go on. Yeah.
I know you said it in the beginning. If I ignored the first part.
Well, I suppose Christ, if this is ultimately a picture of Christ and the church, then Christ and the church are not interchangeable, are they? The church does not die for Christ, and Christ does not submit to the church. So you can't exchange the roles, and you can't have two Christs or two churches, as it were. So I think it's because ultimately this is about relationship between God and his people, and they're different. That there is to be the difference of male and female in marriage, and that God has created us male and female, so there might be that picture. And then, of course, also, that, I mean, what I haven't talked about is actually the the way that that new life in terms of children obviously can be is the sort of the fruit of their love. Yeah, so that, I mean, that's a very, does that help at all?
Why it's uniquely male and female.
Yeah. And I kind of, so that, like, says that's another seminar in itself, which I decided I wouldn't try and do that in the same one. Because I think that we do need to be able to say that. You're absolutely right. We need to think about that. There's a book I was just started reading, which does, I think, very helpfully deal with this in a chapter, which is edited by John Piper and Justin Taylor, I think, called Sex and the Supremacy of Christ. Typical Piper title. So there, that would be a resource to sort of explore that particular issue further. Yeah. James?
Yeah. Have you got a page number for that atonement quote?
No.
Okay. Secondly, in a marriage service across the cultures of...
It's very near the beginning of the book.
Okay. In a marriage in cultures around the world, you basically just need the couple and honest.
Well, the principle is faithfulness pledged publicly. You might say that one witness would, you know, meets the minimum criteria, but why would you want only one witness? I suppose I'd say, you know,
so it's public.
It is public, yes. And if, you know, to have one witness but to do it secretly would be sort of to undermine the principle.
So is that it, basically? The couple, yeah. Public and the promises, yeah, of faithfulness.
I think so, unless someone who knows better than I could add another essential ingredient. Yeah. I think there should be food as well. Food. No. It was hard to have a big party.
Yeah. Do we see that public element in the Old Testament? And do you know?
Well, I think it's the fact that basically sort of having a wedding and having a feast seem to be synonymous, and it's a bit of a shame to have all this food if there's nobody there to eat it.
So we do have that feast idea.
But it's probably almost taken for granted, you know, that is the understanding. And that knowing who is married to whom should be a publicly known. I mean, there are, for all of this stuff, there's sort of biblical illustrations you could do. So on inadvertent intrusion, think of when Abraham goes down into Egypt and says that Sarai, his wife, is his sister. And so who is it? It's Pharaoh who you know, takes Sarai into his harem. And then he is shocked and horrified when he finds out that Sarai is actually Abraham's wife. And he is inadvertently intruded on that relationship. And so their marital status should have been public. You know, wedding rings are important because that's public. Yeah. Other questions? anyone with the gift of interpretation? It's great to have the reminder of the other aspect of married life. Yes. No? Okay, well, let's draw things to a close there.